Good evening. You are tuned to KGVM Bozeman. We are the audio mirror of the Gallatin Valley. We're on your radio dial at 95.9 FM and we're online at kgvm.org. It's time now for health and happiness here on KGVM.
You, Gallatin Valley, have come to our program, Health and Happiness, again. 95.9 KGVM, kgvm.org. Thank you. I am Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist with Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. The Montana Psychological Association Public Education Committee inspired the initial program, and now we are working on our eighth year as we continue. While focusing on everything happy and healthy, our program today focuses on an element of our lives we now find essential to health and happiness. Dr. Suzanne Wood will now introduce today's program.
There are 5,193 public airports in the USA. Approximately 2.9 million persons fly on commercial airplanes daily. And we have some good news. From Forbes, CNBC, and others, we learn that commercial flight has become roughly twice as safe each decade since the 60s. And from the Bureau of Transportation Statistics, commercial airline flights are the safest means of transport. They are 1,700 times safer than car travel. If you compute by the total number of miles, commercial flights then are only 130 times safer than cars. So maybe we should all consider flying more. Mm-hmm. And today we have with us one of the hardest working individuals in the state of Montana. Help me welcome Brian Springer, who's been helping Bozeman Airport daily since 1977, if I'm correct. He's been hardworking and then heading up the Bozeman Airport at one point since it was a large tin shed. He has brought it to be the busiest airport in Montana and the most beautiful airport in the USA. Even New York City's recent new airport upgrades cannot compare to our warm fireplaces and cozy eateries with a mountain view. Welcome, Brian, and tell us how you decided to work at an airport in 1977.
Well, thank you for having me tonight. It was a little bit later than that. It was actually 1983.
Oh.
But I was heavily involved in the airport world even back then because my parents were both airline people, and my dad was actually the station manager for the old Frontier Airlines here in Bozeman, and we moved here back in 74. So even in 77, I was hanging out at the airport probably more than some 12-year-old should.
Yeah. Well, that's great, and that kind of presented an interest in continuing with airport work for you. And you went to MSU, I understand?
Yes, I think even from a very young age, I was destined to be in some kind of the aviation world. I thought for a long time I would be in the airline side, was for a long time. And that afforded me the opportunity to work at the airline while I was going to school at MSU. So it was a really good combination, getting experience while also getting a good education.
So what did you do back then when you were at MSU as a student when you worked at the airport?
Well, I think I was one of those that focused on pretty much work and school. I didn't play as much as maybe some might have. Not that I didn't have some fun. But I focused a lot on the business side. Business, marketing, and finance were my areas of education. Looking at kind of the future, knowing that I probably was not going to be a pilot. My interest was more in kind of the management side of the industry, so that was the focus in school.
That's amazing, and I know that over the years, there's been one whale of a transition from one level to the next level to the next level up to being just an amazing airport that we have today. I remember coming down the escalator from the flight and hearing people for the first time coming just amazed at the fireplaces and the beautiful Montana setting. And so we're very proud.
And
of
the bison, as they see when they come up.
Yeah.
And we've watched visitors from Japan, ooh and ah, and visitors from other places. And how did you come about such a rare ambiance for the airport and make it so beautiful in addition to utilitarian?
Well, I think, you know, really that goes back to the airport board and management back in the mid-70s that really wanted to focus on creating a terminal building that was more ski lodge-like. That was at the, middle 70s when Big Sky was just starting out. So there was a lot of focus on really kind of making it a very pleasant place to come to, warm and inviting. And then ever since then, my predecessor and the boards that we've seen over those years have, really focused on trying to maintain that ambiance through every iteration of expansion that we've had. And I think, that's one of the key components when we talk to architects is don't mess it up.
Yeah.
We want to keep it, very much with an ambiance and a welcoming and inviting environment.
Well, I personally just want to thank you. It's always such a warm, wonderful homecoming. And after all that glamour and beauty in the airport, you step out and breathe the fresh Montana air and see the mountains. So it just is the perfect opening to Bozeman and Montana.
I think we often say that, we have great artwork in the terminal, but the best artwork is looking out the windows.
Oh, yes, yeah. Breakfast by the windows, looking out at the mountains and the sun coming up. One of our favorite things, yeah.
It's hard to beat that.
Oh, it is. And one thing that really, truly impressed us in reading about some of your work at the airport and the ways you've upgraded and upgraded and upgraded over the years was that when you started your expansions, you did that debt-free.
Mm-hmm.
Now, nobody is able to do that these days. You just don't have that. We were totally impressed. Tell us about that wonderful ethical thing.
Well, I think, certainly we in the past we've had to borrow at different times to get things started. But, I think in this most recent expansion and actually a couple of them before, we really focus on trying to, have the money in hand before we start a project or knowing that we're also going to be making, hopefully bringing in money while we're doing the project. So, we really try to look out well in advance and time our expansions such that we can do that most cost effectively and hopefully with a plan that allows us to not borrow money. It just gives us a lot more flexibility in operations. One of our key, I think, things that we look at is, you know, really having airline service is the golden goose. If we have airline service, then everything else falls into place. And there are a lot of airports that borrow a lot of money to build Taj Mahals and you know, facilities that, you know, may be bigger than what they may need. But sometimes it comes at the expense of having higher fees for the airlines, which ultimately will result in higher fares for passengers. And, you know, we can't control everything, but we know that we can, you know, control pretty much what we build, how we build it, and how much we spend. And so if we can do that well, hopefully we continue to make it, you know, something where people can travel. We can give more competitive options. Can't always say it'll be the cheapest fare, because, you know, the conundrum there is sometimes the cheapest fare ends up with an airline that no longer is here. So we want them to make money, but we also want them to have give us choices for our local population and those that want to come here.
Do they essentially, like, pay rent or lease?
Yeah, they will pay us actually two different fees. One is what would be called a landing fee. So every time they land an aircraft, we charge them by the weight of the aircraft that's landed. And then we also charge them by, you know, per passenger that goes through the terminal. Generally, you know, across the country, our fees are probably half of what is, you know, common in the region, and often a quarter of what you'd see in the rest of the nation.
Well, all of that is to be highly respected and appreciated. Thank you for that. I do think I might personally have to take credit. Arliss and I had a dear friend of long many years who is one of the vice presidents at Southwest.
Uh-huh.
And it was shortly after they came up to visit us in Bozeman that they then decided they needed to be in the Bozeman airport. So,
well,
can we take credit?
You can. You know, there are stranger stories of why an airline changes, you know, changes direction and comes to a location. We'll take every advantage that we can, and, you know, believe it or not, that does make a difference, because if they can. If people can see, you know, the destination, you know, it helps people understand what they're trying to sell. And I think that's part of the reason why we've been so successful is we have a number of reasons why people come here. And the more reasons that people have to come here, the more opportunity there is for better air service.
What would you give us, say, the top five reasons people might come to Bozeman?
We look at kind of the four main pillars for us, and that would be, you know, the city of Bozeman area, the business market for the for this region. We would look at Montana State University. We would look at winter tourism and summer tourism. So those are really the big four. If you're to add a fifth, you know, I think you have to look at, you know, the great outdoors and quality of life that bring people here to want to live.
You know, and our family moved here because there was a high level in the technological computerized world, mm-hmm, of experts here that provided a work base for companies. And so even in the technical areas, I see that Bozeman has an up.
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly that has a big impact as well. You know, I think that, you know, when we look at, you know, reasons, you know, why people want to live somewhere, you know, things are different than they were 100 years ago or 50 years ago. You know, we look at it, you know, 100 years ago, the center of the state was kind of Butte because of natural resources and such. 50 years ago, it was Billings because of trade and, you know, all the, you know, the thing, you know, the center of, you know, distribution for various goods and such throughout the state. But today, it's more information-based and IT-based, and people can choose to live wherever they are, irregardless of trade or resources. And so they choose a place like Bozeman because it has a, you know, a really high quality of living, a place to be where, you know, people want to be.
Mm-hmm. What are the airlines that you have here?
So we have United, Delta, Southwest, Alaska, American, JetBlue, Sun Country, and Allegiant.
Oh, that's a 7, 8.
Eight, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is your busiest one?
United, followed very closely by Delta.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they serve different types of markets. Mm-hmm. United really kind of focuses on the largest cities in the country, like, you know, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Houston, Chicago, New York. And Delta really kind of focuses on, you know, all of the other markets and connecting them through places like Salt Lake City or Minneapolis or Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed in some of the customer or traveler ratings, you mentioned, I think, the four of the top 10 that are in there. I think Delta, United, Alaska was amazingly high. I hadn't known much about Alaska. Mm-hmm. Apparently, it's a very quality sort of group.
Alaska is a very popular here because of the ties, particularly to the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, when we look at where people moved to Bozeman from, that's one of the areas that, you know, is very strong. And so Alaska has a very loyal following in that region of the country and consequently here as well.
We had an interesting connection with the airport on the show recently.
Mm-hmm.
We had the MSU team who created a computer that could go into outer space.
Uh-huh.
And it had to be in a protected box, which could not be opened. It had to stay immaculately clean in order to be able to go into outer space. And they had created the only one that was impervious to the gamma rays, or which rays in space, I think. And so they talked about how they had to work with the airport very closely,
TSA.
Mm-hmm.
Which would give you a role in getting some equipment to the moon, Brian.
You know, it's amazing how many different, you know, functions and different things that happen through, you know, through the airport that you never even realize are happening. And we were aware of that, but, you know, it's often, you know, there are things that even we don't know.
It was 2 or 3 years ago, wasn't it?
Sounds like about right, yeah.
And you think you're bringing a box to the airport and saying, you can't open this no matter what. So that was good that you all could work together.
Yeah, so that's generally something the TSA frowns on. So you really want to get that arranged in advance.
Yeah. I was amazed when we got our TSA, whatever the allowance 2 years ago, I think, and the lines separate. You can go mm-hmm. to TSA one, or you can go to the regular one, a line to check in. And there still aren't that many people, relatively, who go the shorter route there. I'm wondering, hey, you ought to do that. It's much more convenient than is it just people just put it off? Or
I think, you know, it's interesting when we look at the different demographics of people that are traveling, that there are still a lot of people that may only fly once every 5 years. And we see that, you know, the inexperienced traveler, when they go through the terminal, you know, there's anxiety producing, and you know, can be a challenge. And, you know, I think that, you know, it's one of the things that we also say, you know, in, particularly in our area in Bozeman, we have a lot less inexperienced travelers because people are from so many different places. And, you know, that means that they're, you know, more prone to feel like flying is an option. But you can certainly imagine some people who have rarely traveled by air. You know, you add in all the complexities and security, you know, how do you get your bags checked and what do you do when you get through security? You know, for someone that's rarely done it or never done it, you know, it's a more of a challenge. And so, you know, we often will actually assist people that have those concerns. You know, we try to respond, you know, to any email questions or anything that we can help alleviate that. But, you know, there are still, you know, times where, you know, some people, you know, choose not to travel by air because of that anxiety.
Suzanne was letting me like the research. She does most of the research on all of this, on that, how 2001 changed so many things in that area, security. But also there was an interesting connection with Bozeman on that day.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that, son?
Yeah, it was, you know, certainly a very terrible day with everything that happened, you know, with the hijackings and such. But, you know, one of the unique things that happened while that was going on was the Federal Emergency Management people were in Big Sky. And it wasn't just the federal, it was also those state organizations as well at a convention there. And so when that all was happening, particularly in New York and Washington, D.C., they were here. And, you know, obviously they wanted to be where, the, you know, they needed to be. And so there was very quickly, I know that, you know, the Gallatin County Sheriff's Office mobilized to get them down the mountain from Big Sky down to the airport. And then we made available one of our conference rooms. And, you know, I know that the national director for FEMA was, you know, basically coordinating a lot of what he could coordinate at our airport while he was waiting for aircraft to come in to take him to the East Coast. And same thing for the director for the New York FEMA. You know, he was here as well, and you can imagine, you know, he had a lot of need to get to New York City. And so while the rest of the nation was pretty much shut down for air travel, we were seeing military aircraft from, you know, like the New York National Guard to the Air Force coming in here to pick up many of these individuals to get them to their respective states, particularly those that were impacted on the East Coast.
Mm. That had to be just almost an overwhelming feeling, the responsibility along with all the shock of what had happened, and you all were trying to get all the teams back in place.
It was, you know, certainly, you know, paled in comparison to those individuals. We were, you know, we were looking at, you know, things like securing any aircraft that we had at the airport. We were, you know, working with, you know, the airlines and the passengers that had been affected, had to, you know, create, you know, perimeters around the terminal at the time. And basically, you know, our focus was, you know, secure everything first, but then, you know, start the response to be able to reopen. One of the things that isn't highly known was we were the first airport in the country that was authorized to reopen. The unfortunate part for us was that, you know, the airplanes that needed to come here were still waiting for the airports they were at to reopen. So we still had to wait another day or so before we could see our first flights returning to the air. But, you know, we were pretty proud of the fact that as the airport itself, we were, you know, approved to reopen with the additional security procedures and everything that we had to have in place for that.
I remember so well that feeling of, oh dear, what just happened, but what could happen next? So you all were having to secure the premises and take care of the entire FEMA team and deal with the shock of the events. Yeah.
Yeah, it was, you know, hopefully a time that none of us ever has to go through again.
Well, we're with you on that. Our daughter was walking to class that morning and watched the planes hit the building and called us on the phone.
She went to school in New York City.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was just beyond even just being scared. It was amazing that you guys were so integrally involved, and I know you've had several incidences where you had to rise to the occasion. I guess sanitation and cleanliness on aircraft have always been concerns, but then you had COVID come along. That had to be a real fun thing.
Yeah, COVID, I think, you know, you know, we had some precursors with some of the things like SARS and some of the viruses before, but it had never, you know, came to the United States to the degree, you know, that was there. One of the, you know, things that we were watching very closely before COVID really kind of, you know, happened here in the United States, or before it really we saw the biggest impact, is we were watching closely what was happening with air service in Italy, and saw that, you know, service between a place like Milan and Rome that would have, you know, dozens of flights per day, dropped down to like one flight a day, and we saw that, and you know, I think we started a little bit earlier than most, preparing for just the decimation in air service that we would see. We even advised our board a couple of days before the before the nation basically got shut down, that we would probably see less than 10% of our passengers that we would normally see in April. But at the same time, we knew that we were pretty confident that we would recover quicker. And the reason we thought that was because after having watched what happened after September 11th, we knew that people would, when they did start to travel again, they would most likely travel to places that were rural in nature, be more nature-oriented, and not travel as much internationally and avoid big cities. And sure enough, that was what, you know, happened. And, you know, I don't think we fully anticipated, you know, the desire for people to come to Montana, but we did. It wasn't a total surprise either.
So you more or less prepared to have an influx of people once they could see the light there.
Yeah, we felt pretty confident that it would, that we, our service would return, and actually even by June of 2020 we started to see that recover very quickly, and actually by April of 2021 we were at record levels of passengers, but we also had a lot of things that we had to work with, is all the restrictions and masks and everything that came with that. you know, I think there was some, you know, certainly some misconceptions about every buddy coming to Montana that by air was potentially bringing COVID. And there were some certainly some concerns about that. What I don't think many people, you know, understand is that only about 10% of the people that come to Montana come by air. 90% come by cars.
Okay.
And while you can slow things down at an airport, it's very difficult to put a gate up at the state line and say you can't come in.
Good point. Good point. Wow, that was a time, wasn't it?
It certainly was. Mm. You know, I think, you know, our when we were in the middle of a terminal expansion project, and certainly there was some question, you know, should we slow that down? Should we continue? And our board was very supportive in continuing, and it was
brilliant.
Fortuitous that, you know, we did get everything completed because we needed every gate that we had when it was done.
On a somewhat different topic, we're old enough to remember when President Reagan pretty well fired a whole bunch of the
air traffic
controllers. Mm-hmm. PATCO, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Called. How has that evolved or changed since then?
Well, you know, I think that was certainly an example of a, while I was not in the airport industry at that time, I was very aware of that, you know, that sudden impact. And the impact was, you know, basically a very sudden reduction in air service throughout the country, particularly with some airlines. Building that back up has been a challenge ever since. You know, bringing in air traffic controllers, you know, and our airport isn't immune to that challenge. In fact, I think, you know, as one of the, you know, the growing airports around the country, you know, whenever you're growing, you tend to have more of the challenges of increasing staff at a time when there's a shortage of staff throughout the country. And so, you know, I think we're on going the right direction, but it is a very challenging job. And, you know, I think recruitment for that has and will continue to be a challenge. But at least I think right now the focus is on trying to overcome those challenges.
Well, according to the AP News, how big is the shortage of controllers? The FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, has about 14,000 air traffic controllers. More than 1,800 were hired last year. Still, there's a need for about 3,000 more to fully staff the system. So we still are understaffed.
Absolutely. And of course, the challenge is for those that get hired, there's also those that are retiring and leaving the positions. That being said, I think there's also room for improvements in technology, and I'm, you know, cautiously optimistic that we'll see some of those improvements. You know, even at our airport, we're continuing to work on technology here that generally would be paid for by the FAA, but because of our size, we don't justify it from the federal government, but our board has a standing desire to do whatever we can to improve whatever we can. In fact, the air traffic control tower was built by the airport, not the FAA. Our radar was paid for by the airport.
Wow.
And given to the FAA to operate. We pay additional funding to help recruit air traffic controllers here. And even, you know, more of our recent projects, you know, we're working on additional navigational aids to reduce the minimums for planes landing in low visibility so that we can, you know, have fewer diversions or cancellations because of bad weather. So all of those, you know, things, you know, sometimes it's working toward technology. You know, we're working at expanding our second runway, our parallel runway, so that it has more capabilities to handle large airline aircraft as well. Not because so much we need to have the two runways, but the redundancy gives us the capability of operating when we might have a disabled aircraft or maintenance going on. And so, you know, there's also things that from an airport that we can do to help alleviate some of the challenges, even in air traffic control and also helping get airplanes in and out.
It doesn't surprise me that you're so aware of the status of things and working hard to address those issues. It's just kind of sad that in other places especially, the controllers are forced to work mandatory overtime because there's a shortage, and many work 6 days a week. That's led to concerns about fatigue. And the FAA agreed last summer to increase the minimum rest time between shifts to make sure that people were able to stay awake. And in some high traffic areas, including New York and Florida, the FAA has limited the number of flights because of this lack of controllers available.
Yes, it's a nationwide challenge, and
big one.
You know, I think that, you know, we're at the, you know, early stages of making some of the biggest differences and making it better.
Is the mandatory retirement age still 56?
You know, I would have to check on that, but I believe that is true. Because it is a very stressful job. It requires, you know, a lot of mental capacity and energy. And, you know, I hate to say it, but my mental capacity isn't what it was when I was 30. So I totally understand why they might have some restrictions on age as well.
Mm-hmm. I was reading how the training happens at the FAA Training Academy in Oklahoma, and about one-third of the candidates can't make it through that program. But we get others that come in to the airport areas through the military experience and training, although there are fewer and fewer of those, I was reading. And so it can take how many years to become an air traffic controller for anybody out there wanting to try, Brian?
You know, it's the amount of time is, you know, actually can happen fairly quickly if you have a really good aptitude toward it. It doesn't require advanced degrees, although those certainly help. And so, you know, but it does require being able to, you know, have the aptitude to, you know, be able to logistically control aircraft. You know, that's not something everybody's wired for. And I know I would not be. You know, it's certainly something that if somebody has that aptitude, you know, they can get into it pretty quickly. And it's also, you know, the pay is pretty good. But, you know, there's, you know, I would encourage anybody that has that interest to pursue that.
The job availability is terrific, and the pay is high. It can be stressful, but they are trying to work toward alleviating that. So anybody out there considering a career should consider.
Yep. Federal employees, all of them?
Not all of them. In fact, at our airport, they're actually a contracted employee. The larger airports, we're kind of right at that cusp where, you know, I think, you know, we're hopeful that at some point we will see our airport as federal. But, you know, certainly our, you know, pretty much any airport larger than us is going to be a federal control tower or also, you know, and they have various versions as well. They have what we'd call a center and also approach controls. So there's a lot of variation. But primarily, you know, the FAA is going to be hiring through the Fed, you know, through the federal side or contracting it out for some of the smaller airports across the country.
Well, there's another kind of shortage you also have to deal with, which I'm sure makes your job more stressful. There's a big shortage of pilots.
That is, you know, certainly been part of, at our airport, one of the reasons for a lot of aircraft activity, because we have the Gallatin College that has a flight training program. We have another flight training school at the airport. So they are actually training pilots on a, you know, regular basis. In fact, I would say there's probably over 100 pilots in training at any one time, flying in and out of our airport and getting, you know, experience. So, you know, on a nationwide basis, there's, you know, certainly the airline industry is hiring, and that can be a challenge also because there, you know, in more recent years, there's been times when there's been airplanes but no pilots.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. I think that's gotten a little bit better over the past couple of years because of all the flight training that has been going on. But, where the impact off it is that the smallest airports across the country, they will lose air service because, you know, the smaller aircraft are going to be the first to, not have the pilots because the airlines make money on bigger airplanes than smaller airplanes.
Well, it's just remarkable to hear that we are somewhat shielded by all the flight training taking place in our area. So that's a big benefit to you guys,
It's certainly a very big part of the activity at the airport. We're focused on aviation, so we support, you know, everything from airline operations to cargo to flight training to air ambulances to aerial firefighting, charters, private jets, anything that pretty much needs a runway, we're going to support flying in and out of the airport.
So you have a lot of private aircraft that land?
Yeah, and, you know, I think if you break it down, we do, in total operations, an operation is a landing or a takeoff on one of the runways or at the airport. We do about 22,000 airline operations, about 19,000 private jet operations, but we also do about 30,000 flight training operations. And then we have a whole lot of other activity as well, but those are really the top three in terms of what's using the airport. So the flight training is a significant activity at the airport.
Much helicopter activity?
We do have quite a bit of helicopter activity. Most of it is based upon air ambulance.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a strange question, but I've noticed every day, about the same time, there are helicopters, at least one helicopter, that comes from the southeast going northwest. And I'm going, every day, is this person delivering someone to private dude ranches? Are they, or is it fire control, or... Do you have any idea what that might be?
I'd have to look further into it. If it's coming from the southeast to the northwest, my guess is it's probably a relocation of an air ambulance from the hospital to the airport.
Okay.
More often than not, without looking into it further, I'd have to. That's my best hypothesis at the moment.
I was going to say, it seems you might want to consider scholarships, because in looking into this, I saw that flight school at Colorado Springs says that most charge between $70,000 to $90,000 for pilot training. The ATP flight school said it costs $116,995 to become a pilot when starting with no previous experience. Now, you can work it down to $86,000 when starting if you have a private pilot certificate. So we're encouraging young people to come and try to be a pilot, and we need more pilots. But what about that situation, Brian?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the while the cost of education is high, the potential salary is also quite high. So there's an element there as well. And also, I think what we've seen is some of the airlines are working with flight schools to create a pathway through the flight school into directly into jobs at the airlines as well.
That makes sense.
So okay. There's a lot of different pathways that I think are being tried to alleviate that shortage of pilots, and I think in general they've become pretty successful at that.
What about the... so many people have pets, and we go to airports and always see dogs, maybe occasional cat. Any experiences you could share with animals that everybody finds either negative or positive?
You know, we've certainly seen an increase in animals traveling over the course of my career. But I remember some cats that were quite noisy back in the earlier times of my career. I've seen some dogs that are just the most kind. They curl up into the smallest possible ball that they can to by their owner's feet. And travel with no impact for people. I've seen, occasionally two pets in the terminal that don't like each other. So we've seen, a number of different things. But I would say that, over an expanded career, those have been, the negative sides have been very rare. The positive sides have been, more the norm.
Do people buy an extra ticket, or they just pay an animal possession fee? Or?
Yeah, it depends on the airline and their policies. So some airlines have policies that are more conducive for traveling with pets. Obviously, service animals are a whole different, element in the travel. Obviously there are some times where the larger pets will be carried in the cargo hold and such. So it kind of varies on the, where the passenger's traveling, what airline they're traveling on and such.
Yeah, we had to take our little Yorkie at one point, and So we contacted the airlines, and in a little carrier, it slid right under the seat in front of us, and we gave her, the veterinarian gave her a little sedative, so she was relaxed, and there was no trouble at all. So would you advise people to, if they want to bring a pet or need to bring a pet, would they need to call and make arrangements? What would be the best way to handle that?
I think there's kind of two elements there. One is obviously the airline, you know, contacting the airline and making prior arrangements. I think the other one is, like you did, is, you know, make sure you work with your veterinarian. There are, just like people we were talking about, anxiety, you know, there are some pets that anxiety, you know, is very difficult, and you want to make sure that, you know, that kind of environment is, you know, something that is safe for your pet. You know, we don't like to hear the stories, you know, any more than anybody else does, of where a pet might not make it through the flight. But, you know, that's, you know, something that, you know, why it's, you know, I think so important to, you know, get, you know, a professional to evaluate and give you advice on whether or not, you know, the pet should travel.
Was there a recent increase in the visa fee for international travelers? Or did I?
$250 fee if you're coming in from another nation. So have you noticed that impacted your international travel lately?
That, what we understand is that is just starting out, and it will be specific to certain countries. But, you know, I definitely would say that we have seen a change and reduced international travelers coming into the United States this year. And, you know, certainly we've seen, you know, travel from Canada particularly less.
Yes.
And, you know, they're taking their money elsewhere to, you know, a lot of warm weather destinations in the Caribbean and Mexico and such. And so, you know, I think, you know, that's one of our concerns is, you know, I think, you know, from an airport standpoint, you know, one of my favorite, or, you know, I think parts of the job is watching, you know, the excitement and the passion and the emotions of people traveling. They travel for the best of reasons and the worst of reasons. And, you know, seeing the, you know, the many different cultures that come through the airport. And so anything that kind of makes that more difficult is, you know, something that is, you know, very, I think, challenging for myself to see, because, you know, I am a traveler. I like to travel. I like to see other places, the cultures. I like to see, you know, and meet people from wherever. And so, you know, it makes me, you know, I think sad when, you know, you have opportunities for people that might want to come here and for whatever reason they're choosing not to. And I think, you know, certainly that's, a challenge right now, I think, you know, and when we add cost to that, you know, I mean, you can imagine if, you know, you add a $250 for a family to travel, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking if you had five members in your family, $250 a piece, that could put a real weight on your trip.
And I think it also, you know, even for those that do choose to still travel, and they if they still choose to come here, very likely there's $1,000 less to spend here. And so, you know, I think long term, I think those are some challenges. You know, we know from, you know, that the airport contributes probably, you know, in the neighborhood of $1.5 billion to the, you know, Southwest Montana economy. And so for every passenger that we have, we anticipate that that is about $900 to $1,000 of economic impact for the area. Well, you know, if you have $250 more to come here on an international side, now this is very simple math, you know, that means they may be spending less on retail or, you know, maybe, you know, one less good, nice dinner or so that, you know, I think that, you know, we have to be careful with, you know, making too many changes, because if we discourage that travel, it can certainly have an impact on our economy in Southwest Montana, and you know, and I think, you know, because of where we're at and the amount of travel people do here, it would become pretty noticeable if we, you know, saw that go somewhere else.
That's kind of heartbreaking to think that we're limiting those wonderful people from around the world to come to Bozeman. That's part of the charm of Bozeman. You run into people from everywhere in Bozeman. Or did. Yeah.
You mentioned something. Pardon me. You mentioned something earlier I found fascinating. It sounds like Bozeman Airport has taken individual responsibility for even some of the finances that normally maybe one got from a FAA, like the tower.
Mm-hmm.
Is that unusual for an airport to do that?
Generally, that's unusual. Often, you know, and part of the reason for that is because we're one of the fastest growing airports in the country, we kind of, we have a choice. We can wait for us to justify it through the federal government, which, you know, I think all of us would probably say that the federal government isn't always the quickest. And so if we wait for that to happen, we will reduce the ability to serve the need. And so we step in to do that, because if we do, then we create opportunity for ourselves. And I think that, you know, is really the difference. But when you're really growing quickly, you know, the federal government, you know, still often deals with data from years ago, and I'm dealing with data from today. So
it's really a great investment then.
Absolutely. I think some of our success has been that would not have happened if we had not invested in many of those upgrades.
So here's your opportunity if you have job openings at the airport. Is it difficult to work there? Are there hurdles because of safety concerns? Or is it just like any other job application?
Well, we have about 40 different entities at the airport that employ about 1,600 or 1,700 people.
Oh, my.
So there are many different opportunities. But being at an airport, often the two big ones are that because it's often safety sensitive, often you have to be at least 18. And secondly, it's very security sensitive, so you do have to go through security background checks for most positions, no matter what entity you're at the airport.
I assume that. And so we'd like to encourage people to consider it, but also be aware that there's a process that keeps everyone safe. Yeah. Well, what would you like to tell people? We don't have a lot of time left. What would you like to say to all of those potential flyers out there?
Well, I think that, you know, we're very fortunate from all of us at the airport to be able to really create an airport that, you know, serves, you know, so many people and has access to so many different places that, you know, we're not just a small town in Montana. We're connected to the whole rest of the world.
Well said.
I'd like to say in our final few seconds here, in under a minute, I'd like to thank Suzanne for such a fascinating guest, very educational. She does the research, finds people to be on the show, and this is absolutely fantastic. You're so knowledgeable and had fantastic experience.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for coming.
It's been an honor.
And all of Gallatin Valley, be sure when you go to the airport, thank everybody there who works there for being such a good, competent, compassionate group. This is KGVM 95.9, KGVM.org. Please tune in for the other programming. This will air on, like tonight, 7 o'clock, and also again, 9 o'clock on Thursday mornings.